911, what's your emergency?
Yeah, the girl who bullied me in high school took me out to coffee this time.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Do you need an ambulance?
No, it's fine. We worked it out. I wanted to riff on it a little bit.
That was fun. That was good. That was good.
Okay.
Well, listen, guys, welcome back to the First Risk Podcast. And before we say anything, I just have one thing to say to my dear co-host, Jane. Happy birthday to you.
My worst nightmare.
Happy birthday to you.
As of right now, it is the day before my birthday. And by the time this episode airs, it'll be approximately 4 or 5 days after my birthday. So this is great on every...
Are you two? Are you three?
My cat is like loudly playing with a toy a short distance away. This is probably going to sound, all of this is probably going to sound terrible on the recording.
Well, I think that is charming and is just the energy we need going into this session. Everyone say happy birthday, Jane. She is officially 25. She's officially a quarter of an antique. So welcome to the club. You know, I'm right there with you. How do you feel about turning the big 25?
I mean, basically old as fuck. And we all need to start de-aging now. Everybody put on your retinol, get your Ozempic ready, and, you know, put those things on your face, tape your mouth shut at night, put on that face shaping thing at night. You don't deserve to have a moment of peace the older you get, because the only worth that you have is your physical appearance, and especially the perception of youth of your physical appearance. And so you should spend your life miserable that you will never be as young and beautiful as you hope to be. And it's only going to get worse. And I think this is healthy, and I think we should all feel that way.
This is like one of those Twitter posts. It's like, everyone needs to get more anti-aging now.
Except they're usually not coming from that perspective. But, you know, I just thought I'd be a little subversive for a change.
So you're feeling good?
Yeah, I'm feeling so good. Oh, my God.
Yay. We're adults.
And you know who else is probably stressed about the horrors of aging is this mommy vlogger that we opened the episode with. By the way, this episode was directed by David Grossman and written by Lindsay Beaulieu. But do you guys care? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, we should pause to praise Lindsay here, because this was a good episode for her. I feel like she has been on an upward trajectory with the episodes that she's been writing, because she started pretty low, and she's doing a lot better in season four. You know, so go, Lindsay.
Yeah, I thought this was good, but I especially like that she brought mommy vloggers to the 911 universe.
God,
because we open with this mommy vlogger. She is giving her kid a baby birthday party. She's giving him a old-timey pin the tail on the donkey, everybody dressed up as farmhands, little birthday party. And then we cut to the kid, and guys, he's like 13. This poor child. He is too old for this, and he knows it. He is not having a good time.
Poor Bryson. The episode opens with the framing device.
Of course, his name is Bryson.
Right? He opens with this framing device. She is live streaming this on Instagram or whatever. Maybe a TikTok moment. That was a thing by this point. And it's so obvious that, like, this is one of the situations where, like, she does this to pay the bills, and she's very interested in, like, the clout and the social media success, and her son wants absolutely nothing to do with it. He's so sick of it.
He tells her, maybe you could be a normal mom and not go live on the gram. I know I'm always telling my mom that.
I'm also always telling my mom that. I break out the Ouija board. We have a great session. This kid, I mean, it's such a absolute like 21st century nightmare that he's living in. And like we've seen how these things go down. You know, we all watched that documentary series and that other one. And
that other one.
And that other one, and that other one, and all those J. Aubrey videos. And so we know how this thing goes down. He just wants to play paintball and laser tag, because he's a young kid at the Great Wolf Lodge.
He's like 13. You know, I think they say he's turning 12, but it's like, even at 12, you know, you're becoming a tween. You're like reading manga now. You don't care about pin the tail on the donkey. You want to spend your birthday going bowling or playing laser tag and eating a lot of pizza and pretending you're a teenager.
When I turned 12, we went to see the first Avengers movie in theaters. And then we came home. This is dating me. That feels like so long ago. Oh my God. I turned 12. I was young. Okay. It came out literally like right next to my birthday. I think it came out on my birthday, actually, May 5th, 2012. So we went and saw that. And then we came home and we had a zombie themed birthday party.
Oh, that is so 2011.
It was so 2011. And we had some kids who were zombies and others who were like the survivors from The Walking Dead. And we had like, you know, like plastic guns and whatnot, killing all the zombies. It was fun. It was a good time. All that is to say, I get this kid. He doesn't give a fuck about pin the tail on the donkey. And so he goes on the trampoline with his buddy, and all of his friends are like, this is so weird. What's going on?
In this day and age, they probably just want to play Fortnite.
Oh, yeah, actually. Fortnite and, like, I don't know, what else was out at this time?
They want to drink Bang energy drinks.
Oh, my God. Remember Bang energy drinks?
They want to watch Jake Paul and play Fortnite and drink Bang energy. Finally, the kids get on the trampoline and the kid's like, what am I going to have to do for my mom to think I'm grown up? Like, start paying taxes? And meanwhile, the mom is like, okay, kids, let's play pin the tail on the donkey. And yeah, it's so clearly for her and not for anyone else. Like, she just wants to have the appearance of this adorable kitty birthday party. So she starts playing pin the tail on the donkey, and we get this great Final Destination style cross-cutting between her gearing up to play the game and the springs of the trampoline, the rusty old springs slowly detaching, slowly getting more and more strain put on them. And finally, just as she's about to pin the tail on the donkey, a bunch of springs fly out of the trampoline like bullets and pin her hands to the shed. I don't know if this is a thing that can happen, but one goes right in her back, too. So this is not ideal, but they do say karma's a bitch.
Karma's a bitch. And hey,
this should happen to every mommy vlogger.
Sometimes she comes up to your door, and what does she have in her purse? Oh, it's tetanus. Right.
Yeah. This lady better get a tetanus
shot. Those are
shot.
Rusty ass springs. And let me just say,
rusty
as someone
as
who had like a trampoline growing up, I have never, ever heard of the springs snapping off and like shooting off in another direction. And I abused the fuck out of that trampoline. So the important piece of context here is that the trampoline and all the decorations and everything, they were provided by a company for a sponsorship that this mommy vlogger took. So I love the implication that the only sponsorships she can get, because she's not that popular, are like really low end ones, like really bottom shelf sponsorships that provide
this
her with rusty, broken down trampolines and like decorations for like a 2 year old's birthday in like 1987 or something.
On the other hand, the payout from that lawsuit could be huge for her. But yeah, she's lamenting that her son doesn't care about the birthday party, even after all the hard work she put into it. And one of the firefighters is like, well, look, I mean, you did a great job building this shed. And she's like, oh, it's a prefab. I just made it out of a kit. It came to me from some sponsor. Like, so even the work she has put into it is kind of passionless.
Mm-hmm. Very passionless, very performative, like,
yes.
Like even
oh my
more
God, this
so.
Performative mommy vlogger. Canceled. She's
canceled. Cancel her. It's so manipulative. Ugh.
Yes.
She's her
probably
hand.
A narcissist.
Now, the 118 does, like you said, they roll up. She's a sociopath. And her fingers turn out to still be mobile. And so it looks like, you know, it missed the tendons. There's no nerve damage. But the one in her back is about millimeters from her spine. So they can't risk taking, well, I guess they can't risk taking it out, obviously. But they can't really risk moving her too crazily either. Mm-hmm. So what they do, they're like, oh, Where's the guy with the saw? Buck! Buck, get over here. Where's Buck? He is...
Buck, like a third-rate birthday party magician, he is standing around entertaining the children by doing show and tell with his firefighter saw. And he's like, oh, yeah, this can so saw cool. through anything. One kid is like, you could probably go through bones, too. And Buck's like, yeah, I guess. I mean, we don't really use it for that. he's doing a great job.
He's doing a great job, and then, you know, Bobby like chastises him, and so he comes over and he cuts the door off.
Sorry, kids.
And so they get her off, they get the door off of its hinges, and they're transporting it over, and they can't fit her into the ambulance, so what they do is they ferry her over to the hospital with the door laying flat atop the fire engine. Oh my god, what an image. What an image.
How embarrassing.
The consequences of her actions. They roll up to the hospital and the kid meets them there. And yeah. he grabbed the phone because it turns out she was live streaming that entire time. And now she's gone viral. And they are going to be so wealthy. So wealthy. She's going to
right.
start.
It's funny. There's no resolution to this. Instead, the kid is like, yeah, mom, I'm feeding into your social media addiction now.
That's
but
strange.
That's something I like about this episode. I have commentary on this episode, which is this episode, there are parts of it that are kind of imperfect, but like resolution-wise, but in a way that reflect parenthood itself. Because this episode is called Parenthood, by the way, which almost feels like a little in-joke because I believe Peter Krause starred on Parenthood earlier in his career. And I feel like this, and kind of like the Athena and May thing, not getting wrapped up in a completely perfect or satisfying way, I feel like it reflects the messiness of parenthood. And that's actually like very beautiful in a meta way.
Yeah.
So think about that.
I really like the idea of that. And I also like the idea of the fact that this mom, now that she's super viral and super famous and probably has a lot more well-paying sponsors, she's going to start her next live stream with, man, getting impaled on a trampoline spring through a donkey door was really, really hard for me and my son. That's why we partnered with BetterHelp for... for accessible therapy to make our pain go away. Here's a code for you.
Now that I'm recovering from these terrible injuries, I really don't have much time to cook anymore, which is why today's video is sponsored by HelloFresh.
You love Squarespace. Build your trampoline website today.
I'm trying to think of other ones.
I the only other one I can think of is like I had a lot of time on my hands while I was recovering from being impaled on a donkey door, and thankfully I had Raid Shadow Legends to bide my time while my body healed.
You know, my hospital bills were really piling up, and I started to think in a larger sense about my finances, which is why today's video is sponsored by Rocket Money.
God.
We have fun on this podcast. But basically, in the hen-wren household, the hen and Karen and Denny are all sad because they're giving up Nia. You know, the next day, Nia is leaving for good, and... we get a great scene where Denny comes to Hen and Karen at bedtime. He wants to sleep with them for the night. And they have a real, like, honest talk about how they all feel about it and how Denny's feeling about it. Because he has anxieties not just about losing his, you know, surrogate sister, Nia, but also knowing that he was an adopted child himself. He's feeling this fear of, like, if Nia's getting taken away to go back to her biological mom, is somebody going to come take me away from the people who I
Denny.
Think of as my parents?
And
yeah, like, you could see how a kid would think that. But Ken and Karen, of course, reassure him that, no, like, we have a legal right to you. We have sorted this out, and you are our child forever. Mm-hmm. So that's nice.
Karen says, we even have a piece of paper from a judge that says so. I just love the way that she said judge in that sentence. It tickled me. And it's a very sweet scene. But he starts asking about you know, this obviously brings up some questions he has about his biological mom. Oh, haven't heard about her in a minute.
Right.
it's always kind of a jump scare whenever they mention Eva. Is it Eva or Ava? I keep forgetting.
I think it's Eva.
Eva. Okay, I wrote down Eva. And it's always a jump scare when he asks about Eva, or Eva just comes up. It's like, no, no, don't trigger this in Hen. She's going to cheat again. She's going to cheat again. Denny, don't do it. Don't do it. And, you know, they are honest with him in a way. They explain it in terms that he can understand where, you know, she was sick. She had to go away for a while. She went to jail. They took him in and they love him like, you know, he's their biological kid because he is their kid. And, you know, after all of this, they'll still have each other. And it's very sweet. It's very sweet. And so the next day, oh, this scene was hard. This scene was so hard. Denny is saying goodbye to Nia, the social workers there. There's two social workers there, actually. Mm-hmm. And he says to Nia, you know, I know I always got mad when you took this off of my bed. It's a little blanky. But I want you to have this to remember me by. And then I also want you
little unicorn
to have
stuffy.
This, the little unicorn stuffy. And she asked to play waiter with him. And he can't. And then they say it's time to go. And she's like, Denny, come with me. And it's like, oh, fuck you, Tim Minear. Fuck you, Lindsay Bolio. I hate you. I hate you. You're going to start coughing.
Hen and Karen one more time. And they're like, you never actually named your unicorn. And she's like, Softless. I'm going to call him Denny for my big brother. And raise your hand if you cried.
Raising my hand. I'm raising my hand.
Then it's
time for her to go. She gives her a kiss and she says, I love you, Nia. And then she's walking out the door and she says, see you later. And then Hen immediately is like, no. And then Karen's like, yes, we will see you later. Bye, mm-hmm. Nia. We love you. I love you. And then the door closes and like everyone kills themselves.
It's extremely emotional. It's just a very sad scenario. And, you know, they ask Denny to go into the kitchen. They're like, Grandma Tony is making you a special lunch. I should hope so. Because, yeah, this is a rough day. I hope she's making something very good.
They didn't have Tony's actress on set this day. So what they do is they ADR some like kitchen noise sound effects in the background, like some like plates being moved around and stuff to communicate that Tony is present in the world of the scene. Even though I feel like she would have been here for this.
Hen and Karen are talking to Deirdre and Karen's like, you know, I really didn't realize it would be this hard when we started the process. I wasn't thinking about the day we'd say goodbye. And Deirdre's like, yeah, I know. I've done this a long time. It's never easy. A lot of people never go back for a second placement. They just foster the one time. And Karen's like, well, yeah, I guess we'll have to think about that. And Hen says, like, there's nothing to discuss. I never want to do this again. Which is, like, tough, but also understandable. Because this has been such a traumatic process for them and their whole family.
Yeah. And so we go from that broken home with the, you know, grieving mothers and the child who doesn't understand to a little slice of heaven with little G... Little Jiyeon at home, and Chimney is doting over her. He's watching her. He's so obsessed with his daughter. He has to go to work for his first day back, but he just wants to sit there and watch her. Maddie tells him to go. He's going to be late. And he's like, what if she does something cute while I'm away, etc. Then they hear a fall in the other room.
Yeah, meanwhile, Albert is just tripping all over the place in the other room. Albert is, on the one hand, seemingly, like, fully recovered. Like, he's
not
visibly... Not
a scar on his face.
Not a scratch
on
his
visibly, perfect skin.
Visibly, he is totally fine now, so that's good for him. But, like, I guess he's still got some neurological symptoms he's getting over. So one of those things is balance. And so he was trying to, like, reach for something off a shelf, and he fell over. And Chimney's like, you were supposed to be resting. Like, this is what the doctor meant. But Albert is being very dramatic. He's like, you already have one baby. You don't need to take care of two. He doesn't want to ask for help.
And like, I get that. But like, if he has like nerve damage or, you know, he's like physically like mobility impaired, I get that he's frustrated, but like he's being a bit of a baby about it at the same time. It's like, just accept your fate, Albert. You're weeks into this process. Come on.
Or it's like, if if he were to not rest and hurt himself more, then that would actually be more work for Chimney and Maddie. Exactly. But yeah, he's like offering to make breakfast, and Chimney's like, let's just not overdo it. Just get some rest. Don't worry about breakfast.
He asks if Maddie likes waffles. Oh, Pookie. Pookie Bear.
Albert's kind of having a Buck moment where he's like, I feel like all I do is rest. And he's feeling antsy. He doesn't want to, he wants to get back to his job, presumably, of delivering food. So
very fulfilling work for him, you know, with the car he doesn't have, by the way, because it was totaled.
He presumably is going to want a change of career soon because he can't exactly go back to delivering food. But sadly, Chimney's got to rush out of there because it's time for work. And also Maddie's like low-key, she's flirting with him and he's like, well, we're sleeping on an air mattress in the living room, so we can't do anything about it. But he's got to rush off to work. And he says, text me every time G does something cute. And she's like, oh, so like every other second? It's like, yeah. Because she's cute.
Yeah. Cute baby.
And they're obsessed with her.
And we know that he's obsessed with her because we cut to him at work in uniform with Buddy, gathered around the kitchen island, and he's showing off the first time that G smiled. And Eddie, the experienced father that he is, starts negging Chim. He's like,
specifically, he says, are you sure that's a smile? Because that's the same face Buck makes when he's gassy, which is like, bro, why do you as a man know your best man friend so intimately that you know the faces he makes when he's gassy, you couple of weirdos?
Weirdos. And also, does that canon mean that Eddie thinks Buck is cute?
He thinks of him like a cute little baby, yeah, but not in a weird
way. It's now, well, I mean, we do know Eddie's into role play, so, you know, but anyways. God. Bobby, he comes over interrupting the buddyism of it all. And he says to Chim, you know, what's that thing they say about having a kid? Having a kid is like walking around with your heart outside of your body. And
Chimmy's,
you know,
like, ew, gross.
And it turns out Maddie is, you know, they have opposite schedules. So right now she is pulling double duty watching both G and Albert because they have two kids. And they are not seeing each other with their contradictory schedules. They have no time together because they are too busy working full-time jobs and taking care of these little rascals, these little rugrats. Now, there is another elephant in the room. Address me. Because who should be ascending the stairs at this very moment with what appears to be a cake from Magnolia Bakery in her hands? But the one and only grieving mother that is Henrietta Wilson.
Yeah, and Chimney's first instinct is to like put the phone away, stop talking about the baby, and be like, oh yeah, the Albert's doing great. You want to hear about Albert? Because he assumes that Hen, having just essentially lost a child, will not want to talk about his new baby. But she wasn't thinking that at all. She came in with a new father cake. She's like scolding everybody for not being more openly, you know, welcome back, Chimney. Like, they didn't put up a banner. It is crazy that they didn't put up a banner when, you know, they are historically big on banners. But yes, she's like, Chimney, like, it doesn't matter that I'm going through this. Like, we celebrate the wins where we can take them. And I'm your best friend. And I'm still excited that you had a baby. So she asked to see the baby pictures.
I really miss in season two when they were putting up the banners for Chimney's welcome back party. And Hen was just going full military. Things were so much simpler for her back then. She's at such a difficult moment in her life. And I don't want that for her. I don't want this for her. Ah! Anyways. She's being so normal about this. And then we get a ringing of the bell. Is it diegetic? no one responds to it, so we don't know. I guess it's just a scene transition, like how on Glee they would just have like the class bell ring to like transition into new scenes, but no one would respond to it.
Maybe the B shift is gonna handle this one. They like lost a bet and they have to answer all the calls for the day.
Then why are they here? Why is the A shift here?
It's just where they like to hang out when they're not on the clock. They like to,
let me get
so
away
obsessed
from my wife and baby, am I right? You know, let me hang out with the boys.
They're so obsessed with their jobs and their coworkers that even when they're off the clock, they put on the uniform and come back to work.
Oh god. But yeah, we cut to this guy, this like young-ish guy who appears to be
young-ish
breaking into
did y'all catch the guy shade?
I'm shading the guy so hard. We're getting ageist to this episode. It's a very ageist episode. But Jane set the tone at the start, so blame
true
her.
But I was blame joking, the I woman was being funny. Okay,
blame
yes,
the woman, everybody. He's breaking into the house.
We cut to kind of a 911 call setup. And yeah, there's this young-ish guy who is breaking into a house, seemingly. He's like all dressed in black. He decides to break in by climbing the rose-covered trellis, the beautiful like fairy lights trellis in the garden. And he gets up a few feet and uh-oh, it starts to come away from the wall. He topples over and breaks his body. So he's got to call 911.
He breaks his body really hard. I did not remember that this was called a trellis. I wrote down in my notes, rich people flower wall. And then when they said trellis later in the scene,
who the fuck is trellis?
No, even worse. I flash back to the song McCavity the Mystery Cat from Cats. And the trellis past repair. When the crime's discovered, then McCavity's not there. Right? He's McCavity. But he's like, he is incompetent McCavity. Like, McCavity would never. This guy
McCavity
is no
McCavity.
McCavity
would land on his feet because he's a cat.
He's a pollicle dog. He's a pollicle dog. He's no Jellicle cat. Okay? He's a pollicle dog and his legs are broken. Right? So
he calls
911 and
May
Grant answers.
Yes. And he's like, I think my legs are broken. I fell off of this thing. She's like, okay, can I have your name and location? He's like, here's my location. Do I have to tell you my name? Like, I don't
he's
see why that's
all this,
relevant.
By the way. He's
yes.
fully whispering this. May's like, well, I guess I'd like your name, but I can dispatch stuff in the meantime. Meanwhile, Josh, one cubicle over, gets a call from the same house where there's a couple inside, and they're like, help! We heard a sound in the front yard. We think someone's trying to break in. We're an older couple, and we're defenseless, and we don't have a gun. What are we going to do? Please send the police. And Josh, he notices that there is another call from that very location happening at the same time. And so he and May lock eyes.
And she goes, my broken leg was breaking in?
What a quote.
Great line, Lindsay.
What a quote. Wow. And so the 118 responds, of course, as is their job. And the older couple runs out to see the guy on the lawn. And the woman instantly recognizes him and is like, oh my God, so-and-so? And at first you think, oh, it's the mistress that she's been sleeping with behind her husband's back. But then it's not.
This guy is their adult son, and he's got this bootstraps dad who's like, oh, you're God. Such a freeloader. You've been coming into our house and bleeding us dry. We finally had to get a restraining order because you were taking us for everything we've got. And, you know, you have options. You could go get a job and pay rent. But obviously the mom is easier on him and is like, you're too hard on him. So it's an interesting dynamic. He was breaking in because he doesn't have any other place to stay.
Yeah. Here's the thing. So I understand, like, you know, intellectually the quandary that this adult father is in. where his son's kind of like a, you know, a do nothing guy, whatever, who's like, I don't know, he sees him as a freeloader or whatever because he doesn't have his life together. I hate him. I hate this father. I hate him so much. So it's like, I get where you're coming from, but man, you're not helping your case by being such an asshole about it. And I feel a lot worse for the kid.
And although we are to understand that the son is spoiled and the mom is too protective over him and stuff, we do end the scene more against the father, because what's eventually revealed, Athena Grant is on the scene, by the way, what's eventually revealed in the presence of Athena is Bobby realizes that the bolts attaching the trellis to the house have been cut. It's like someone tampered with them. It's like someone knew that the son would be trying to break in through the trellis and set him up to fall and hurt himself. And when Athena hears this, she's like, that sounds like a bit of a crime.
And so what does she do? She cuffs him and she books him and she puts him in the back of the paddy wagon. Now, I will say, I would be remiss if I did not mention that in this scene, Buck sticks up for the kid.
Well, I mean, Buck has had a rough go of it as a child, and even as an adult child, where you can see why he would understand.
Which he is.
Yes, you can see why he would understand. He would want the parents to go easy on the kid who takes a while to grow up, right?
Yeah.
And there's also an interesting moment where the dad is going on about, like, you're always the good cop and I have to always be the bad cop. And Chimney's like, can't you both be the good cop? And Eddie and seemingly Buck, it was hard to tell because they were wearing masks. It might have just cut to a shot of both of them and it was just Eddie talking. But it looks like both of them say, no, like, you can't be the good cop, which is like, oh, so they're saying that because they're both parenting a child together.
Yes,
that's what I
exactly got
from the scene.
I have to agree. There are so many like different like things about parenting, like different perspectives and everything coming at you with like the frame of this horrible situation. That's like a nightmare for all involved.
And again, isn't that what parenting is, right? Like they don't have they don't have this clear cut, one of them's in the right and one of them's in the wrong. It's like, no, they have this whole messy, complicated relationship because the parents haven't raised the kid very well. And so he hasn't turned out that great.
I mean, I agree with that. I completely agree with that. And it's very fascinating. But as someone who does, you know, regrettably eventually want to have kids someday, God
wow,
help
lame.
Them. You know, I was just watching this and I was just thinking to myself, wow, I give up. Like, I guess there's no answer.
You want to have kids someday? I thought you hated kids.
I hate other people's kids. I'm going to love my own. I'm going to love my own kids more than anything in this world.
Isn't that like the worst kind of parent to be? Because you'll show up to like, you know, a conflict happening between your kid and another kid at school and you won't be understanding at all. And you're just trying to defend your kid and the parents. I mean, the teachers all hate you and the other parents all hate you.
I don't give a fuck about the teachers. I don't give a fuck about the other kids or their parents. I give
a
fuck about my kids.
You should give a fuck about teachers because they're underpaid and they're very hardworking.
Not my problem. I'm here for my kid.
See, they're going to hate you.
My kids will not hate me. They'll love me.
Okay. Well, everybody pray
this
for
is
Ryan's
why,
future
no,
children.
No, Jane, this is why I got so exhausted watching this episode. This is why I got so exhausted watching this scene. Because I'm like, wow, I guess I can't do it.
Wow, the episode of 9-1-1 that convinced Ryan that he shouldn't have children.
I think we should all watch this episode. I think so few of us should be having children. And I think that we should all watch this episode to, I don't know, maybe convince us to get a vasectomy or to get our tubes tied or to just, you know, like never bring new life into this world unless it's a plant or a dog or something like that.
I mean, I guess I would agree. So that happened.
Or play.
So that happened.
So that happened.
And back at the old Han household, Buckley Han household, Chimney gets home. He's exhausted. And Maddie rushes in and she's late for work and she's got the baby and she needs Chimney to take the baby and she's got to go. And, you know, Gian needs to eat. So there's a bottle on the stove or whatever. And Albert needs to go to physical therapy at 3 and bye. So Chimney's like, did you get all that? Me neither.
And then
he and his wife don't have any time to even hang out together.
They don't. They don't. But what I do appreciate is that now the perspective shifts to Maddie, because we've been getting only Chimney this episode so far, and I wanted some Maddie time. And so Maddie, she's at work, and what should happen as soon as she walks into the break room, love her walking right into the break room first things first, everyone comes out to greet her with a cake and baskets for a surprise, little surprise, you're a mom. Congratulations.
Linda has a great corny line where she's this basket's for baby and this one's for mommy, and it's full of, like, you know, wine and cheese and fancy little jars of olives. I love it.
Linda is so funny in this scene because she tells Maddie, she gives her a piece of advice, which is to never take anyone's advice, and then she starts giving her just like a bunch of spitfire advice.
Well, something about this scene is it makes it sound like Linda has kids of her own, like she's speaking as if from experience, but we never get to find out much about Linda.
I
think season 10 Linda Bates Maine, that's what I'm 10, arguing for.
Linda Bates Maine, the top billed stars are the actors who play Linda Bates, Ravi Panikkar, and Taylor Kelly, because we're bringing her back.
Yeah, everybody else leaves the show except for those three people.
That's
honestly
our 911 season 10. I would watch that too, honestly, because you have like all sides there and you don't have like a horrible cop storyline, so it's great.
And then and then buddy canon would be confirmed off screen by, like, you know, Ravi comes in, he's like, I just got off the phone with Eddie, he's gay now. Wouldn't that be funny? Okay,
we have evolved past the need for on-screen
buddy canon. We still need it, but I'd accept it if it was off-screen.
We've evolved past the need for on-screen buddy canon.
Imagine, Ryan Guzman also is like, I'll do it, but I won't be there.
And because we all are now watching Heated Rivalry on HBO Max and Crave and wherever you watch the show.
I'm not doing that yet, but I don't know. Maybe if I get really desperate, I will.
Jane, you need to Fujo out. It's like insane. I thought it was going to be like boring and chase like Red, White, and Royal Blue. And like it is, it, like, they fuck nasty, nasty, like nasty, nasty. So it is very good. And also it's just a good show. I like it. What can I say? Now Josh, after the party breaks up in a very TV way, it's like, everyone go back to your jobs, you're at work. Josh is like, wow, I don't know what's going on, but I'm here for you. Just don't ask me to babysit, because that sounds like a lot of pressure. And she's like,
I'm sorry,
I got
this
you, babe.
Scene not like, is it not a little homophobic the way they have to keep throwing in your face the fact that, like, Josh is so unfamiliar with, like, babies? And I don't know, it feels like they're making this very concerted effort to be like, well, I'm Josh and I'm gay, so babies, I don't know anything about that, crazy pregnant lady. I, like, don't ask me to babysit because I'm gay.
If it's homophobic, then that just means the world is homophobic, because, to be frank,
well, the world
I wouldn't want to babysit either. So I thought it was very true to life. I was feeling seen in this moment and identified with Josh.
I wouldn't want to babysit either, but I guess it just felt a little over, like, you know, Josh even says in the episode, like, oh, we have a million people at work who are having babies. It's like, we're supposed to believe that he's, like, never encountered... I don't know. It just felt like they were hammering that home, like, because he's gay in a way that
No, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. It would have been more more aggressively homophobic if they had, like, Jamal appear around the corner and be like, I don't want to babysit either. And then Terry ducks around and is like, yeah, not for me. And then Eddie's there for some reason. He's like, don't ask me. I've already got my hands full doing role play with my weird girlfriend.
Right. That would have been an interesting scene for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But we don't get that scene. Instead, we get Chimney. Oh, if you weren't exhausted by the idea of being a parent already, like, I don't even want to leave leave my room now after watching this scene, because Chimney is getting the full like dad experience while mom's at work.
Chimney he is has being his a fully grown adult baby
Albert on the couch. Yes. In
he's forgetting
weird
to take
pain.
His medication. He can't do anything. G is crying. Mm-hmm. The bottle is on the stove and he drops it on the ground. Who should show up at the door like a savior? But Mrs. Lee. Who walks in, Mrs. Lee. she's like, Maddie didn't send me or anything. I brought over some soup because I had a feeling maybe you could use some help. And it's like, bless, you know, she instantly gets the baby quiets down. She's like, I'll take care of, I'll feed the baby while you guys eat. And it's like, oh, it's like she's come down from heaven to help me out.
Then it's so good to see her.
She even offers to take Albert to his physical therapy appointment, you know, making life so much easier for everyone.
So he didn't say physical therapy, and I don't know why my mind didn't jump there. He just says therapy, and so I'm just like, oh, I like how casual it is in the world that, like, random people go to therapy. That's so nice. No, it's physical therapy. He's getting his mobility back.
It would stand to reason that he could also be going to, like, emotional therapy for
like
the
counseling,
accident.
Yeah.
But yeah, he probably wouldn't have to be doing it in person during the pandemic.
Hey, you know, I took, you know, Zoom acting and dance classes and voice classes over, you know, over Zoom during the pandemic. So if I could do that, then he can do anything.
But Chimney, in this perfect situation, Chimney finds a way to fumble the bag, because what does he do? He accidentally insults Mrs. Lee by saying she mentions that he has this busy schedule. You know, she looks at the calendar and he's like, yeah, but Maddie and I are making it work. You know, we don't want to miss out on a moment with Ji-Yun and, you know, leaving her with strangers, which of course he didn't mean that Mrs. Lee is a stranger. But she kind of takes offense to that seemingly and goes like, oh, OK, well, I don't want to intrude. And she just hands him back the baby and she's like, OK, let's go, Albert. Bye. And Chimney's
and
like,
he's like,
no, don't leave.
And then he spent the entire rest of that day just like cringing at himself and like going over it in his head and like beating himself up for it. Oh, you hate to see it happen. You hate to see it. So then we go from that to a very interesting scene where Hen is sitting very somberly in Nia's room, absent Nia, of course, and Tony comes in to speak with her. Oh, I'm gonna die.
She's like, here you are torturing yourself. And Hen says, like, don't tell me I told you so or whatever. This is hard for me to let go. Don't tell me I knew what I was signing up for. And Tony's like, of course, I wasn't gonna say that. You know, I don't have the answer. And it's kind of just a nice scene where Tony kind of commiserates with Hen, says she hates to see her hurting. And Hen expresses this fear of hers, this discomfort of hers, where she's like, I miss her so much and I loved her so much, like she was my own. And a year from now, she probably won't even remember who I am. And Tony is like, well, you know, she's a little kid. She might not be able to remember individual specific memories, but she will remember like how you made her feel and how safe and loved she felt here. And she's going to carry that with her for the rest of her life, which is such a beautiful sentiment. And, you know, Hen ends the scene by just like crying on her mom's shoulder and like letting it out. And it's like, oh, it's so sad. It's so sad for Hen's family. But I thought this was an effective, like when we're always saying we wish the show would give more time and space to emotional storylines, I kind of felt like this one did. Like,
yeah,
they had them go on a real arc and like gave enough space to the emotional, them going through the emotions of it.
For once for Henry.
And it has
for
like
once.
A coherent arc and resolution.
And so, yeah, it's very effective and I cry a lot and it hurts. It hurts, but it hurts in kind of a good way too, because, you know, Tony's there for her. Now, another family unit is about to have an interesting scene. Because at the Grant household, Athena, she is bringing in the dishes from dinner, And Harry is supposed to be helping her, but May asks him to grab her phone for her, and he goes and he checks it, and she doesn't have her lock screen on, she doesn't have like a passcode on it or whatever, I guess. And so he immediately sees that Layla Creedy, you all remember her from two mentions last episode, Layla Creedy liked May's Instagram post, the opposite of what Ethel Cain did to Lana Del Rey, by the way. She liked her Instagram post, and May sees him snooping, and he's like, what the fuck? What the fuck is this? And she's like, none of your business.
He's like, why are you still talking to her? Like, that's, isn't that the girl who bullied you in high school? And of course Athena is also like, why are you still talking to her? And May admits it. She says she reached out to me out of the blue a couple weeks ago. She wanted to apologize. And Athena's like, right, so you told her to go to hell. And May's like, no, I met her for coffee. I heard her out. And Athena's like, instantly going into a very angry mode. She's like, why would you do that? She made your life hell. Like, why would you even, you don't owe her anything. And May's like, well, you know, like, she's changed and I've changed and a lot has changed.
Why is May more mature than her own goddamn mother?
No,
why?
Literally. Literally.
What is going on?
And when Athena is like, I can't believe you didn't tell me about this, May is like, well, look at the conversation we're having. Like, you always just blow up at me and you don't like the decisions I make. And so I decided to do this without telling you. And she mentions, like, apparently now you don't even like my friends. And Athena's like, you're friends with her? Like, are you letting this girl back in your head again? Which is so, doesn't trust.
Wait, no, hold on. Can I say, in that one moment, I was kind of on Athena's side, because I'm like, I get hearing her out, but what do you mean she doesn't like her friends? You can't be friends with her.
True. May. It's wild that she can be friend, that she would be considering her a friend already again. But, you know, ultimately, it's May has her own agency. It's May's decision. And May's like, why can't you just trust me with this? And Athena's like, because the last time you talked to that girl, you tried to kill yourself. And remember, she's saying all this right in front of Harry. You know, Harry mm-hmm. seems very taken aback. It's not even clear if he knew the extent of what had happened that time mm-hmm. to May. So May is offended by this. She storms out. And it's like, yeah, it's, we can understand why Athena feels so strongly about this, having been the one to discover May after she overdosed. But it's also like, yes, she clearly doesn't respect or trust May's agency. She does not consider her an adult. She doesn't trust her to make her own decisions. And she hasn't really, she's done the thing where out of fear, she has moved into overprotective mode rather than healthily moving on from the incident.
This is such a TV moment for me, because it's like, mm-hmm. we haven't heard about May's suicide attempt in seasons, and now it's like the writers remembered that it happened. So it's like, we have to make Athena like have this constantly in the back of her brain, which I believe that as a mother, she would have this in the back of her brain. I just don't think the writers had it in the back of their brain at all. But I respect Lindsay for making it such a thing. I just wish it was more consistent across the rest of the show.
Yeah,
because it's kind of a big deal. But
I mean, they brought it up recently in season 9, remember?
Yes. However, that hasn't happened yet.
Yes, no, correct. And it's not like they had really been consistently bringing this up from seasons 2 through 4.
And I'm not even saying that like it has to be like brought up at every opportunity. I'm definitely not saying that. But like just like a one-off mention like every now and again, or like just even to remind people that like
I feel like maybe there's been some of that.
That it happened, because like before this like storyline happened, did anyone remember who the fuck Layla Creedy was? Most of the people who were fans of this show at this point hadn't even seen season 1. You know what I mean?
It's probably true.
They started for Buddy and Jennifer Love Hewitt. And I get it. Love those things. Love those divas. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, this is a thing that happened in, like, episode 3, episode 4. So it's like, it's weird. It's season 4, it's like, oh, and making her dramatic reentrance is the trauma and fallout from May's teenage suicide attempt. Like, okay, we're back in it. Okay, all right. So that was just funny.
I'm gonna be so honest about this, Ryan. I don't care that much, and I think it's fine.
Well, that's good for you.
I know, it is good for me. I feel good. But good. We cut to Chimney and Hen rolling up at some lady's house. They knock on the door. They're like, yeah, we got a call about an overdose here.
And I can't wait to see all the comments that are like, oh, I agree with Jane. Sorry.
Oh my God, I'm the favorite. No, I think it's just in this. I'm sure some people do agree with you. And like, there are moments on the show where I agree too. It's just, this is one of those times where I'm like, eh, whatever. Like, it doesn't really bother me.
All right.
But, you know, I'm unbothered. I'm in my lane. Skin is clear. I'm feeling good.
Yeah, not me. Not me. My skin is breaking out. I'm swerving between these lanes like you know, I'm driving a Hummer and I want to merge without looking.
Like you're about to cause the pile up from the previous episode.
Exactly.
But Hen and Chimney roll up to this lady's door. They ask about the
overdose.
Good
luck, everyone else.
She's like, well, I didn't call 911. Like, what? I don't know of any overdose here. They're like, we got a call from an Ellen Saxton. She's like, that's my mom. They run into the other room. Turns out this lady's mom is like doing hospice for cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, she's, the woman is caring for her mom like full time. Mm-hmm. Not unlike Abby Clark and her mother. And
there were major Abby Clark parallels in this call.
Yeah, major.
But it's different. It's different in an interesting way because mom in this call is like, she hasn't, for lack of a better term, she hasn't lost her mind yet. You know what I mean? She's made a fully lucid decision.
She says, I'm dying of cancer, but I may have taken something to speed up that process. And they're like, whoa, what do you mean? She's like, I'm not going to tell you what I took, and I'm not crazy. I know what I'm doing. The cancer has spread to my brain. I don't want to live through that. And I know how much caring for me full time has taken over your life. And I don't want to keep putting you through that. So I have made this elective decision to end my own life. And because she shows Hen and Chimney her DNR, her do not resuscitate, they can't do anything about it. And I'm sorry, did she just find a legal loophole for assisted suicide? Is that what's happening? I guess it wasn't really assisted. I guess it was just suicide. But like, is this legit? Could you just do this as somebody with an advanced directive?
Well, it seemed pretty like it. So DNRs are a real thing. You can get assigned DNR form, especially if you are like at the end of your life and like you know that your prognosis for your illness
but
is
short term. But I'm not sure if that
term.
Applies to you actively have tried to kill yourself versus just like you know you're on a ventilator or you're gonna need to be put on a ventilator to breathe.
I'm gonna look this up right now.
I guess it's plausible, but it just seems a little too perfect when like assisted suicide is illegal in a lot of places.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's legal in California. No, I don't need crisis prevention from New York City. I'm not doing this for myself. Okay.
Googling, no. Can you kill yourself?
Attempted suicide.
Wondering why all the results are telling me to seek help.
So I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's a consensus on this. It doesn't seem like there's a consensus on this, but it seems like there's discourse on this in the medical community. looking at this specific case, this is a woman, an elderly woman who is in full possession of her faculties with a terminal illness and a signed DNR from her doctor where there's no evidence that it was, you know, made, you know, with an intention to end her own life. No direct evidence of that.
And I guess I just thought it was odd since she was like awake and speaking to them, like, but at the same time, I guess you are entitled to refuse care, which is also what she's doing.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, if this is in this specific, like, I don't think that DNR would be honored in the event of like a teenager with no medical issues or anything like that. Like, I don't think it would be honored in like Mae Grant's case, but I think in the case of this elderly woman with a terminal illness that is you know, giving her a poor quality of life and has no chance of improving, then I think it's realistic that the paramedics on scene would honor that.
But basically, yeah, Chimney's like, legally, I guess we shouldn't do anything. And the mom takes this up as an opportunity. She's like, I called the paramedics, not for me, but for you, so that you're not alone when I die. And she sits down and she explains to her, like, this is why you need to accept me dying again. Like, I don't want to put you through this. You've put your life on hold. Again, very Abby Clark. Cue not only the landslide needle drop, but also a montage. Say it with me, guys. Random emotional montage of two characters we've never met before. It's a little bit giving those two old gay guys.
It is. It is. But I'm going to say something controversial. This one is even cornier. And I like it even less.
I kind of felt the same. I would say I like it more than the gay guy one. However, this one somehow feels even more like unearned and manipulative. Maybe because it feels like almost like even a shorter scene than we even got with the old gay guys, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, I was sufficiently emotional about the scenario we were seeing in the present, right? That was emotional, seeing the elderly mother tell her daughter what she's done and why she's done it. And so then to cue the song and cut to this corny, to be clear, guys, if you haven't seen the episode, they cut to like a flashback of like the woman as a little girl while her mother is like tucking her into bed, and just like a montage of like their entire lives, her growing up and just how much her mom loved her. And it doesn't help that, no offense, but the child actress is very bad at acting. So it just reads very corny, very immediately. but it feels so manipulative. It's like, why couldn't we have just had this little montage as the woman like slips away while holding her daughter's hand? Like, that's the part that's emotional, because these are characters that we know and are engaged with in the moment, not these random flashback characters.
And can I also say something kind of controversial? They should have chosen a different song. I'm sorry, but like in this particular context, using Landslide, which is one of the all-time greatest songs ever written, but at the same time is also so overdone in every piece of media to the point where it was like parodied on South Park like five times.
So
like,
this is Bohemian Rhapsody.
This is my Bohemian Rhapsody. This is my Don't Stop Me Now moment. Like, I'm sorry, but if you're going to use Landslide for this, you're not going for anything actually, like, you know, emotionally devastating. Or if you are, you're just a hack who's phoning it in. I'm sorry, it's such a weird choice for me, because it's like, it's the most obvious choice they could have gone to, and it's like, you could have done anything else. You could have done other Stevie Nicks songs. That as well. You could have done like any other song. You could have
made me cry.
You could have even done a different version of Landslide. Like what about the Dixie Chicks
something
version? What about the Smashing Pumpkins version? Something a little bit different, to other than just like the same Stevie Nicks version that we've heard time and time again, and they play on the radio all the time, where she begins with a dedication. This is for you, Daddy.
I think they should have done a Jukebox the Ghost song.
You're right. It should have started with the piano trilling and the screeching over the piano, and the my heart jump started,
stupid Freddie Mercury pastiche, but somehow straighter,
and Bobby Nash dies, right? and so the montage to Stevie Nicks' Landslide completes, and she dies.
And I was just a little angry at the scene for robbing the emotional gravity from it by like overdoing it and just doing way too much.
Yeah, I have to agree. It's like, oh, they hit their stride with everything else, and so they got like a surge of confidence. It's like the guy who, like, you know, has a good day at work, and so he goes to the bar and makes an ass of himself after, and it's like, bro, dial it in. Okay, you're doing too much.
So the lady dies.
Chimney goes outside. She sets her daughter free. It's a whole thing. And then it's like, you know, we're gonna. And so she's like, "What do I do now?" And Hen's like,
"Hen offers her some advice. She's like, take her with you and move on."
She
says it like that. It's a little blunt.
I wish whenever like there's a grieving child, like, in front of their freshly dead parent, like the body's still warm, I wish there was a paramedic to go over to them and tell them,
hey girl, you gotta move on.
Move on.
Build yourself a bridge and get over it.
Literally, like we were all here. We all saw what happened, you know. Oh, we all have dead people.
Oh, boo-hoo.
write a blog about it.
Okay, I thought of it more like Hen speaking to her recent experience of letting her child go. But yeah, the phrasing was just a little blunt. You move on.
And now you move on. And like it is good advice in the moment. Well, like in abstract, but like in the moment, mm-hmm. It's like so. Like, that's not what she needs to hear.
Yeah,
it's that her mom's dead, and you're a stranger.
Yeah,
I would have said nothing. I would have been like, so can we pack her up? Do you want us to drop her at the crematorium for you?
Well, I don't think do you want us to pack her up would sound any less blunt to.
What else are you gonna say? What else are you gonna say? Say nothing.
Well, keep it I'm sure strictly she come professional. Up with
anyway. But that's what she came up with, so it's like whatever.
Anyway, Athena is at home regretting all of her choices in life. Mm-hmm. She is like sitting on the patio with her head in her hands. She's reminiscing. That has kind of a positive connotation.
Remember almost dead May.
May almost died. No, okay. She is remembering. She's flashing back to when she found May. Almost dead from her overdose, and she's calling May. May's not picking up. Strong and silent Bobby comes in. He plops down a chair like he's a high school theater teacher, and he sits down and he's like, tell me all about it, baby.
Mr. Shoe over here. Mr. Yeah. Shoe over here.
And Athena's like, May's not answering my calls. Bobby's like, yeah, it sounds like it got pretty heated. And Athena's like, I can't help it. You know, that girl hurt my daughter. She's lucky all I did was arrest her. It's like, okay. Maybe keep quiet. Don't tell us about all the police brutality you should have done to this
girl. Put your gun away, Athena. Like, yeah. And like, I gotta say, like, I was trying to focus on what they were talking about so hard, but I couldn't stop thinking about those boots and that top. Oh my god, her outfit in this episode, in the scene, I was living for it. It's so like simple, like casual, plum, like around the house,
this like plum, like, wine colored tank top, it kind of wrapped, interesting draping. It is nice.
And the chunky high heel boot for like at home sitting on my patio. Oh my god,
right? She was like, I may be sad because my daughter's not speaking to me, but I'm gonna do it in style. Meanwhile, Bobby's over here with his like graph paper plaid shirt. He's not really giving the same energy.
Not turning a look, you know, he's not. But we love him for that because he's dad.
But Bobby's like, you know, I know you don't always agree with May's decisions, right? You didn't want her to become a dispatcher because you wanted her to go to college. And Athena's like, well, no, I didn't want her to become a dispatcher because that job is emotionally taxing and I didn't want her to end up in a mental health crisis again. And Bobby's like, well, it seems like she's doing good with attending her counseling sessions. Seems like she's handling it. And she's an adult now, so you don't have to like her choices, but they are her own. And if she says mm-hmm. she's fine, you know, you just have to trust that she's okay. And mm-hmm. Athena reveals, you know, last time I trusted that she was fine and I almost lost her. And she expresses that most of this is coming from guilt, where she didn't know that this whole thing was going on under her own roof, that her daughter was suffering so much. She assumed maybe it had to do with her and Michael, but no, it was something completely unrelated. So she felt like she missed this huge thing. And Bobby's mm-hmm. like, you have to let go of that guilt. And also, like, in theory, like, it's not May's fault that you feel guilty and feel paranoid. Like, that maybe explains why you feel the way you do, but it doesn't really excuse treating her that way. Like, she doesn't have any agency.
And I appreciated this scene because, you know, it sort of lingers on this fear that she has, that she's living in, of it happening again. And sort of Layla's reappearance in May's life is triggering this fear of this happening again. And it's very existential because, like, what if she succeeds this time? What if it happens and I miss it again? And I have to, you know, this is my daughter. This is this is my cross to bear. And I appreciate how much this scene sort of lingers on that, that emotional experience of a parent in this position. 'Cause I feel like we don't get a ton of that in media. And I'm always very fascinated by like a parent's experience in this kind of scenario. And so that was good. And I thought that was good. But the thing is, this is the thing. The Layla reemergence has been so background that like we haven't had any time for May's like perspective on it.
Yeah. I mean, this is the second time they've brought it up only. So yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of assume I thought maybe there would be more to this, but I'm actually not sure there is.
So I guess we'll see where it goes. And if it goes nowhere, it's like, well, okay.
Well, you know, I think it's more for May and Athena's relationship to get May to finally kind of understand her mom's perspective and to get Athena to finally start to trust May more.
Yeah. So I guess in that sense, it's very in the spirit of the original storyline. So I guess I can't complain too hard.
Yeah, now... you can't complain too hard. And we go straight from that
but I love complaining. You know I do.
Right? I know you do. We go straight back to the Wilson household. And I almost called her Tracy, but no, that's the actress. Karen is pacing around. She's like, Hen, I think I did something bad. I did it for a good reason, but I did something bad. And Hen's like, what did you do? And she's like, I found Nia's birth mother. Whoa. They go to some kind of long-term care facility, like a nursing home. And they're like nonchalantly sitting at a coffee shop across the street or something. And Karen is like, her name is blah, blah, blah. And she works here as a nurse's aide at this facility. And Hen is like, how did you find this out? She goes, I may have hired a private investigator. I love this for her. Yes, this is strictly against the rules.
I love this for her. I love that. I love the idea that she has a PI on retainer for circumstances like this. I know a private investigator. I know my ex's friend is a private investigator, and so I do have one on retainer.
If any,
they still exist. They're still a thing. He is steadily employed, and so if I need dirt on anyone, I can just go to my pal.
Wow.
And I'll have to pay full price.
She says, you know, just like you, I had to know if Nia would be okay. You know, it was killing us. And she explains what the situation is. She found out this girl was a single mom. She was struggling with money and she got evicted. And when she was living in her car with Nia, people saw and called child services, where they placed her with Hen and Karen while the mom got her life back together. And then the pandemic hit, and of course, that's not an easy time to put your life back together. And so one of the few places where she could find steady employment was at one of these long-term care facilities where work was in high demand. And she's been working here since June. She does a great job. And apparently there's even a daycare nearby where they can take Nia, where she can go like spend her lunch hour with Nia. And she's really stable. And, you know, we can imagine that since they were totally in the dark about Nia's mom, their minds were probably going to the worst case scenario, like, you know, are her parents like, is her mom like someone who, like Eva, maybe had like problems with addiction? Is she someone who maybe abused Nia and that's why she got taken away? So they were probably thinking of the worst case scenario. And then we hear right here, and this is a real thing that happens to some parents who are like from low income families and stuff, that like sometimes people's kids get taken away just because they're struggling to support them financially. And in that kind of situation, especially, you would hope that you could reunite families eventually.
Yeah. And so they come to this sort of conclusion that they did the right thing. And, you know, it would be wrong of them to feel a sort of resentment about the situation, because ultimately their purpose in this story was reuniting Nia with her mother, who didn't do anything wrong. She just fell on hard times. Right. And reunification was actually, you know, the good ending here. And so this is like the first moment where they get to accept that. Sometimes breaking the rules is good, actually. And mark, they want to foster again?
Right. Well, Hen realizes that Karen especially wants to do it again. And she explains, I love Nia. I'll always miss Nia. But I'm so happy that I'm proud of us that we were able to give her and her mom this second chance, that we were able to help them with that. So Hen's like, this is, you know, it's going to hurt like hell every time we do this. and we're gonna love them like our own every time.
Henren Christ. Henren Christ.
Literally, they decide that they are strong enough. They, yeah.
Because I'm stronger than yesterday. Yeah. Now there's nothing coming my way.
And meanwhile, at Michael's creepy apartment full of windows, May is complaining about
her
mom.
He's playing Britney Spears because he's gay. No, May is at the end of her rope. She is so frustrated with Athena. She feels so smothered and like sort of how like Athena's being so overbearing with this whole Layla situation, and she doesn't get her perspective. Now, Michael, he sympathizes with May, but he does see Athena's perspective because he was also the parent in that situation. And so it's hard for him to, I guess, really sort of sit and listen to it without, you know, dipping his toe back into the other end, you know?
And he says in particular, he's like, well, I wasn't the one who found you that day. So, like, you know, by the time I got to the hospital, even though it was so scary and confusing, you were alive and I had that knowledge. But, you know, when Athena found you, you weren't breathing. She thought you were dead. And naturally, that's a much more traumatizing experience for Athena to have gone through. And this seems like kind of the first time May has even heard some of these details. So that does alter her perspective on it a little bit. And
there's another thing that might alter her perspective a little bit, because we get, well, not her perspective necessarily, but like there's an interesting like remark here that felt like a reveal, and I can't remember if it was in the episodes or not, which is that the pills that May took were Athena's pills, and that's part of her guilt because Michael told her to throw them out.
No, that was there. That was there when it happened in season one.
God, it was
one.
So, it was literally, we talked about this over a year ago. Wow. Maybe I need to rewatch season one.
That was part of it. And yeah, that was part of why Athena felt guilty at the time. They do kind of frame it like a reveal here, which is interesting because it's not a reveal for the audience. And it's presumably not a reveal for May, who would presumably remember that she took the pills from her mom's cabinet or whatever. So he is illuminating here that a lot of what Athena is feeling comes from this place of feeling guilty for what happened, even though, of course, May is like, well, I don't blame her. And, you know, neither of us ever blamed her.
There's still a question of like, did I endanger my daughter by, you know, leaving access to these pills that she then, you know, used to try and take her own life? And it's like, that's a conflict, right? And so May, in order to, I guess, come around to understanding Athena's perspective, she goes to at work, I guess, and she pulls up the she pulls up the audio archive from that day, and she listens to the call that Athena made to 911 when she found her. And it's a harrowing listen. It's an absolutely harrowing listen. It's, you know, what you'd expect from a call like this, where you know, she's not breathing. Athena is extremely distressed, we get like a very like full like run through of like her entire sort of breakdown like process here, like just listening through May's ears. We remember that May was 14 when this happened. I was having trouble remembering her age when this happened.
Yeah,
that was welcome. And it's very, like, I know I said it's harrowing, but yeah, it's quite difficult to listen to, because it's just a mother discovering her daughter, and having to give saving breaths and, wait for assistance. And, you sort of see like May, like in her eyes, like have this like out of body experience, where she's really coming to terms with what happened. It's interesting, and it's all new audio, I believe. It's all new audio because this wasn't
some
in
of it is
the episodes. And we sort of leave it on that note of the call ends, and she's like, "Fuck, I did that."
Well, you know, she cries a little bit.
Yeah,
and yes, and that's like, where we leave for now.
Mm-hmm. I get it. I shouldn't be friends with Layla Creedy, that bitch.
That'd be funny if that's how this episode. We just see her like unfriend her on Facebook.
Block her on everything.
Block her on everything. Back at the Buckley Hahn household, Maddie walks in back from work, and she sees Chimney from the back, like changing Gia, and she's like, "Oh, great, you're changing her." Chimney doesn't respond. She walks over. Chimney has fallen asleep standing up. He's like leaning against one of the like structural pillars in the house. He's conked out. He conked out right in the middle of changing a diaper.
Love that the reveal was that he was sleeping. For a moment there, I thought he was standing there like the Blair Witch. But yes, he was just standing while sleeping. This is quite dangerous to fall asleep while your baby is in an unsecured location, as any eagle-eyed Degrassi viewers will know. Because remember that time that Jenna left her baby alone to go work on a song and then it fell?
Yeah. Well, Maddie's commiserating with Chimney. She's like, yeah, the other day I fell asleep while I was holding her while I was on the toilet. And it's like a funny moment, but I was thinking like, damn, you fell asleep while holding her. Like, yeah, you could have dropped her on the ground. But maybe since she was on the toilet, the baby was kind of on her lap. I don't know. It's an interesting picture that they paint here. But basically, they're like,
I wonder if anything like this will come up in the future. I wonder if anything like this will happen in the future and it will trigger something horrific and awful for one of these characters to endure.
Well, they're like, how do other people do this? And Maddie's like, I think we might need help. And Chimney goes, I know just who to call. And guess what? It's Mrs. Lee. She's back. I guess Chimney made up with her. And, you know, as he's handing off G, well, first of all, he's not bringing her over as a babysitter. He is dropping off Albert to live with the Lees. It's like, we're getting rid of one baby.
Oh,
no, literally,
God.
He has, how many different houses has he lived in this year? Like four?
Yeah.
They're dropping off Albert. And Mrs. Lee actually says that her husband seems kind of excited to have Albert around. And then you're like, oh, yeah, they had a son who died. So that's nice. They get a new surrogate son. And then Mrs. Lee also says, you know, we're also available for babysitting whenever you need. And Chimney goes to grab Albert's medications and he's like, oh, the baby. And she's like, I'll hold the baby for a minute. And so Chimney says like, oh, here you go. Like, go to grandma. And instantly Mrs. Lee is like, oh, I'm not. And Chimney's like, my mom would be so grateful to know that you're here and that you took me in and finished the job she started. And raise your hand if you cried.
I cried. I teared up. My nose definitely crinkled a little bit. I was like,
because it's like yeah, Mrs. Lee is Gian's grandma, and
yeah,
she deserves that title. And she tells Chimney like, you have nothing to thank me for, you know, we're family. And so then as he leaves the room, he hears her go like, don't worry, Gian, grandma's got you. Aww. Raise your hand if you cried.
And then we go from that beautiful family moment to another beautiful family moment where Henren sits Denny down to talk to him about, what if we want to foster more kids? How do you feel about this? Ooh, good parenting moment. Talking to the kid and asking them about what they want to do.
Right. They say, we know we're doing this, you know, that we know this will affect our whole family. So we wanted to make sure we discussed it as a family. Yeah. Not all parents are like that.
No, definitely not. And then we get another thing that all parents do, which is voiceover monologue out of like disembodied voice style, as you see different flashes of other families.
Believe it or not, Hen just starts saying some bullshit, like is always the case with
my
the narration
dad
at
did
the
end this every night. You know, I'd be lying in bed and I just hear dad monologue. And
it's like family. Family like is the most important thing we have. You're like, who is that? Who's talking?
We see a montage. May gets home from work and gives Athena a really big hug. We get a needle drop of a song I didn't recognize, but could already tell I didn't like.
It's Peter Gabriel. I didn't know the specific song.
I hate Peter Gabriel. Oh, God. I didn't even recognize that was him, but that makes sense. We get the mommy vlogger in the hospital, recovering from tetanus, and Madney is having a date night, dinner and a movie. And they're like, what do you want to watch? And then we see them passed out with all this food, and they were watching the baby monitor. Aww.
Wow. You become pretty lame when you become a parent, I guess.
I believe that.
They didn't want to watch, like... like Mission Impossible 2 or anything. They just wanted to watch the baby monitor.
They didn't want to watch Predator. Alien vs. Predator. Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
You know what I watched for the first time the other night? Face Off. Starring
Nicolas
Cage and John Travolta. If I were Maddie and Chimney, I would have wanted to watch Face Off.
Face Off is a good fucking movie. How did you like it?
It was pretty good. I liked it. And speaking of Hong Kong cinema, we cut to Eddie and Marisol, who are on the couch watching. We see like one frame of this movie, and it looks like they're watching a kung fu movie.
What did you say? Did you say Eddie and Marisol?
Oh, what the fuck? That's what I wrote in my notes. Oops. Okay.
Marisol.
You guys, Eddie's relationships with women are so boring that I'm mixing them up with each other. I am so sorry, Ana Flores. Eddie Ana Flores. And Ana. It's literally what I wrote Marisol in my notes. That's crazy. Eddie and Ana are watching what looks like a kung fu movie. We get one shot of like some guys doing flips and like some Chinese writing in the background. I was like, what are they watching? I need to like look up on IMDb if it says. Christopher comes in and he's like, I can't sleep. Can I watch TV with you guys? And they let him. It'd be really funny if they were like, fuck no. Like, we're having a date right now. Get back to bed. But no, they let him in. And they say, that means you have to pick something good for us to watch. And I was like, you're already watching something. You're not going to let him, like, watch what you're watching? Maybe it was a really violent kung fu movie.
No, he'll get nightmares from all the stabbing. Now, drink for Christopher being used as a prop in the closing montage.
I wrote down the yet another moment where the show hastily shoves Eddie's relationship with Christopher into an ending montage because the show has just remembered that he's a parent too. And at this point,
We just talked about this.
And even though I have liked season four, and I think this certainly isn't the worst season for Eddie, the extent to which this show hates Eddie is just too funny. Like, I get accused of hating Eddie, right? But my whole point from the beginning was that it's not me who hates Eddie. It's the show, right? Yeah. Why is Eddie always an afterthought?
Yeah.
They're just tacking on Eddie like he might as well not exist. He had like one line in this episode. And then at the very end of this episode called Parenthood, they're like, Oh, yeah, that guy's a parent, too.
They have too many parents at this point. It's such a domestic show.
It's true.
No one's meeting anyone for the first time anymore. Like, no one has non-parent-related things going on except for Buck. And even then, that's just because he's everyone's son. And so then we go from that to rich mom and son. She's feeding him in his hospital room. I do like that they didn't clean this up at all or resolve this.
Right?
Just like the
we're just to like understand that this entire family has an extremely toxic dynamic direction.
But then you have the dead mom daughter who cleaned out mom's room and is sort of putting on her necklace. And that felt a little too clean for me. I'm sorry. That didn't feel messy enough. Everything else was so like messy and weird. And that felt too clean for me, especially with the memory of the landslide
montage.
So what
should she have done? Like,
I don't know. Like booked a ticket to Ireland and, you know, had a Eat, Pray, Love experience and left her, you know, a weird situationship boyfriend firefighter at the gate
living at her dead mom house.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
That would have been interesting.
You know, I wish there was a show that was all about that and the aftermath of that. Too bad a show like that doesn't exist.
But back at dispatch, Josh is talking about how many fucking people at work are just having babies all over the place. And like a nosy bitch, he asks Sue Blevins, "Why didn't you and your husband ever have kids?" And she says, "I have kids. A whole floor of them," like referring to her employees. And it's like, Sue, I appreciate you. And at the same time, you really shouldn't see your employees as your kids. Like, we should really retain some professional boundaries at this job because it kind of seems like you have none.
No, she's the English teacher everyone loves. She's the English teacher the gay kids get to eat lunch with because they don't have any friends.
I guess that's true. Yeah,
she's the
kid.
Drama teacher, you know?
Fair enough.
Josh is that kid. He was literally just being that, you know, at lunch, at recess, you know, whatever. And so she walks out like the mother of the floor. And then one last circle back to Henren.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, what are they doing? For a few days, they'll be fostering a brother and sister duo.
Mm-hmm.
What was the frame of this fostering? What was like the prompting of this?
Think they just said this will only be for a few days. Their aunt is coming to pick them up, I think.
Okay. So they just needed somewhere to put them in the meantime.
Yeah, we can assume that maybe their parents died or something immediate happened to them and their aunt's going to come take care of them, but has to come in from out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That's
so,
the episode.
That's the episode. That is how it ends, you know? And I enjoyed most of it. You enjoyed it even more than I did, which is very interesting.
It wasn't like my favorite ever, and there were issues, but I thought it was very emotional. Like, rarely do I have like three separate raise your hand if you cried moments in a 911 episode. So I appreciate it for that.
Twice in one scene, you know, we must say. Part of that is, of course, birthday-related feels as well, of course.
You know, I was just on the IMDb for this episode, and I have a couple reviews I would like to share.
Oh, let's hear.
One of them, this is a short one. It's from Armo Kid Backup. 1 out of 10, all caps, this show has gotten so boring. Like, what? May, period. Hen, period. Karen, period. Chimney, period. Maddie, period. Crying, period. That's about it.
What's so wrong with that? Huh? What's so wrong about crying?
Yeah, and then, okay, this is the other review I want to share. This is a 2 out of 10. If you're lactose intolerant, ... you will want to avoid this episode. It was cheese on top of cheese the whole way through. It was so bad that it didn't even tug on heartstrings. It was just eye roll inducing.
How joyless?
I agree that it was cheesy. I disagree that it didn't even tug on heartstrings. My heartstrings were indeed a little tugged. And oh my God, I think some of the other bad reviews are from like misogynistic buddy shippers who hate women because
oh, surprise, surprise.
Because here's a 5 out of 10 review. Here's the title of the review. Did they really have to include Ana Flores, parentheses, the worst character of the show right now in this episode? Which, like, holy shit, what a loaded thing to say. This person says, she always managed to ruin the episode for me, even if she is barely in it. So what is the point? Episode was a 6 for me, but because of Ana, I'll only give it a 5. I cannot wait for this character to be gone. Literally, what has she done? What
I wonder if
she
that
do?
Person has any interesting takes about Abby Clark, Shannon Diaz, or Taylor Kelly that, you know, everyone
needs
to hear
about
in all
that.
Caps on Twitter.
Somebody else says, 3 out of 10, I miss the Buckley Diaz family. So you can imagine what perspective this person's coming from. They say, I don't want to watch Eddie and Chris with this awful character. They don't name the character they're talking about, but I'll give you 3 guesses. They say, anyways, except for the first 10 minutes, which were fun, this episode was simply boring. Sigh. Fuck you, Jocelyn.
Yeah.
Her name is Jocelyn72. Try appreciating women.
Yeah. Try feminism, huh? I want to circle back to that second comment, if I may. How joyless and cynical do you have to be to walk away from an earnest display of emotions from a drawn out storyline with a lot of emotional weight behind it and say that was so eye roll inducing? Like, I get that, like, if it's not for you, if it doesn't work for you, but like,
and also to walk away from that going, those 2 seconds of Ana Flores on my screen made me so mad.
I don't get it. What, log off, like,
but
this is
okay.
What I know, touch grass is over, but touch grass, come on.
No, I would agree, but okay, I'm really getting mixed messages from the scant amount of reviews for this episode, because here's a 10 out of 10 that I also wouldn't exactly say I agree with. This is from Whitney West 10. She says, "I'm not real sure why this show felt the need to rip my tattered heart from my chest just to sew it back again on repeat with this episode. Near sobbing in a bubble bath. Not cute, guys. Believe me. The charcoal mask definitely didn't aid the situation either. But I'm just so happy to have a show that hasn't went full SJW woke with their storylines. That I'll take whatever that display was that I just put on. Heartfelt storylines that anyone that's lived any one of these situations in any capacity can't help but to feel it and remember. Also, crossing my fingers that I didn't just jinx this show so it doesn't go full woke next week. Please, please, oh please." What the fuck?
Nothing could have prepared me for the turn that that comment was about to take.
So, who is this lady that, on the one hand, she's like, "Oh, I was crying in my bubble bath," and then goes, "Don't give me none of that woke SJW bullshit." Like, what is the...
It was Lauren Boebert. Lauren wrote that comment. Lauren... Are you watching 911? How do you feel about Buddy, Lauren?
Like, I hate to tell you this, Whitney, but you're not like a rugged, you know, woman of the American Revolution if you're sobbing in your bubble bath over network TV. And I also hate to break it to you, but this show was already SJW woke, and there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, what show are they watching? They had an entire episode that culminated in everyone getting vaxxed. Like, what show are you watching?
They had a whole episode where, like, a Westboro Baptist Church guy literally got, diarrhea in his mouth and had to be saved by a bunch of minorities despite being racist. I don't know.
That episode was so good. That call
the
was
episode
so good.
Largely revolved around a lesbian black couple doing foster care. I just, like, what does she even mean by woke in this scenario? I'm sorry. I skimmed through that one and I was like, wait a second.
I wonder what constitutes woke. Maybe it's gender ideology is the cutoff point for her. She doesn't watch Lone Star because there's a trans guy on it. Right.
Speaking of Lone Star, anyway, do check out our latest Patreon episode where we finally watched the Lone Star crossover episode, and we even did it with our good friend Justin Gross,
Tolerated
a lot of our complaints.
He did. He was an angel for that. He's an angel. We love Justin. Go follow him on social media. In the meantime, if you'd like to support us, go follow us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds. And if you'd like to support us further, like Jane said, subscribe to our Patreon for Lone Star and a bunch of other stuff. Our December topic poll is live, and you can vote in it for what you want to see this month for your monthly bonus video. So make your voice heard and exercise your right as an American. Because if there's one thing Whitney has taught us, it's that there is nothing more important than exercising your right as an American.
And speaking of which, be sure to join us again next week for another full SJW woke episode.